Well, for the final event of the day, you've made it a long, long way. It's been a long day. We have the judges panel. So Betty Chen is here. She's a partner at Fish and Richardson. She will moderate. She practices in IP litigation, I guess not surprising, both in Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas. And Betty did clerk for one of the panelists, Ron Clark. And I should probably say I know three of the judges very well. I've had jury trials in front of two of them recently. And in the interest of full disclosure, I lost one of them and won the other. And
who was your favorite?
Judge Donato, obviously you, if you're asking. But thank you. And you'll do the introduction. So. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you all. So I wanted to introduce our panel, who probably don't really need any introduction. To my left here are Judge Clark, who I clerked for in 2006 to 2008. And then we have Judge Schrader, EDTX, as well. And then we have Judge Freeman, Northern District of California, and Judge Donato, Northern District of California. So we have two EDTX judges and two Northern District of California judges, and we're going to talk today about three major topics. First is early motions in patent cases, second is summary judgment and claim construction, and third are discovery disputes, and we'll be able to see this dichotomy, or perhaps not no dichotomy, between the way that judges in the two different districts handle these issues. And we want to invite you guys to raise your hand and ask questions as they come to you. This is your one chance to turn the tables on the judges and ask them questions without even having to ask to approach the bench. So we'll go ahead and get started. My first question is directed to Judge Freeman. I wanted to ask, with the abrogation of Form 18 for patent cases, have you seen more motions to dismiss file based on Twombly-Iqbal?
You know, it's interesting. I had expected to see a rash of motions because it seems as though no opportunity to come to court is left untaken in the patent litigation. But in fact, I haven't had any. And it's surprising to me because we're still getting the relatively bare bones complaints that we've always seen. And I think actually in our district and in many districts with the patent local rules, we're requiring the exchange and the production of the claims contentions early in the proceedings. I think that's helping. But it is a motion I blessedly can say, and I thank all of you who appear in our courts not filing those. They would not be met with a smile, but not yet. We have not seen them.
And with the, I guess the follow-up question I have about that is with the Northern District of California patent local rules requirement, where you do have an early disclosure of asserted claims, would you see the abrogation of Form 18 as requiring assertion of specific asserted claims in the complaint, or do you think it's something that can be done during disclosures?
Well, I'm not seeing parties asserting the claims in the complaints. So that I haven't seen. I will say that it seems to me that in the last 6 months or so, the number of new patent filings has been down. That's only anecdotal, but we distribute them equally around the district, so either I got a big chunk of them and haven't seen them for a while, but I am not I'm not seeing that. I mean, what I'm getting is by the time of my initial case management conference, I'm getting, when the disclosure has been made, the defendant is reeling from the unreasonable, I'll put in quotes because defendants always think plaintiffs are unreasonable, number of claims that have been addressed so far.
Okay, and so my follow-up question, I guess, is to Judge Clark on the EDTX side. Have you seen any increase in motion to dismiss based on the abrogation of Form 18, and do you think the pleading standard has changed?
I haven't seen any increase in the motions, and keep in mind when the Northern District of California adopted those rules and we followed that a few years later, the whole purpose was to get all this information out. Mm-hmm. I mean, the judges of the Northern District of California recognized just how complex these were. There had to be something more than just the bare bones pleading. They adopted that rule. Judge Ward followed up and we adopted it in our district. And so have not seen that at all. And there was an earlier panel that talked about what happens on the counterclaims And it's the same thing, because we've also, I think, probably the same as California, have early invalidity contentions. And this idea, one of the speakers said something about, well, we want to get it all out there. We want to lay down a marker for the judges, I think was something that got said. For those of you who are general counsel, and I'm not sure how my California colleagues feel about it, but I don't think I need anybody to be laying down markers on the basic. If you want to pay the bill for all that, fine. And yes, I know you. If you're the lawyer, you want to protect everything you can. But in our local, when you're going to get early infringement contentions and you're going to get early invalidity contentions, lots of motion and briefing on something that's going to come anyway and probably in more detail doesn't make a lot of sense. And you're not really. The judges of Northern District of California know patent law pretty well. You're not teaching them anything with a motion on Iqbal and Twombly. And the Eastern District of Texas judges doing that are also fairly familiar. So that may backfire. Any of you who have been a law clerk know in the first couple of months out of law school, you've already figured out what lawyers you think are jerks. Sorry, I mean, I've heard them talking about that, and you're doing the same thing to yourself, and then you come in something important, and the judge is going, oh, not again. Just a thought. I mean, I'm not saying don't try your own case, but think of what you're doing when you file stuff like that. That it really has no purpose, at least in courts with local rules. I'm not talking about the courts that don't. They're the Iqbal Twombly motions may make some sense.
Well, a follow-up question to any of you guys on the panel is, you know, we've talked about how it hasn't changed the standard because Northern District of California and EDTX both have disclosure requirements for asserted claims and invalidity contentions, but how about counterclaims of non-infringement? I mean, that's not something that's required. So do you guys think that if you do counterclaim for non-infringement, is that something that would need to be laid out more in more detail in the answer? And counterclaim.
Turn on yourself.
Go ahead.
I think, like the other judges, I've just not seen a lot of filings on this issue. It just doesn't seem to be the problem everyone anticipated it to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, every once in a while, I see one of these motions on the counterclaims. I see them across my docket. I think the same of them in patent cases as I do in pro se litigant cases. They're unnecessary. And if you actually want to annoy the judge early in the case, it's a really good motion to file. But in a patent case, this case is going to be with you for a long time, and you're going to be really busy. So this is not, I don't see how this helped your strategy, but it really doesn't help the court in any way. And I don't think you actually get more information that you need for your case early on. With Rule 26 disclosures and patent local rules, I think that's really why we don't see it. And frankly, the extreme sophistication and professionalism among the patent bar, I think, is what's kept us from having the deluge of those motions.
Okay, well, I'm going to change topics to motions to stay pending IPR. So, question is directed to you first, Judge Donato. I know from having practiced before you that you generally will deny motions to stay pending IPR if they're filed before the IPR is instituted. But I also know that a lot of times the defendants feel the need to still file the motion, even knowing that it's going to get summarily denied, just to show that there's been no delay in filing the motion. And do you think that that's something that is necessary, or should the defendant go ahead and just wait until IPR is instituted?
You know, in my view, by the way, ask anything at any time if you'd like. In my view, unless and until the PTAB is acted, there's nothing to see. So wait until then. I don't really understand the argument that it's a preemptive strike against being seen as being dilatory, because there's nothing to stay until the PTAB has granted review of at least one claim in your case. So I'm not going to hold it against you if you wait until then. In fact, I will possibly think better of your sense of timing if you do wait. If you bring it early, I will very likely tell you at the case management conference or the next time we get together that it's denied without prejudice, and that's all you're going to hear. There won't be any additional order, so spare yourself the $8,000 to $10,000 for the motion until you actually have something to do, which, or something to argue about, which is the stay itself. Now, I think the trickier question is, when do you ask for a stay if you have multiple claims in a case, and PTAB maybe has granted review of 10 or 20% of those claims, or you have multiple defendants and multiple patents, and a few claims from here and there have been asked, been taken up by PTAB, but a number of claims haven't. Those are more complicated issues. I do see that actually with some regularity. And I have found it to be a little bit hard to find the dividing line. It's a very practical exercise in some sense. You know, where are the resources going to be better spent? Should PTAB do its thing? Will that materially advance the case in a less expensive, more efficient fashion? But it's kind of hard sometimes to figure that out. That, I think, are, now those questions are worth sending me a good brief on and giving me your thoughts on, because those are the places where I could really use your guidance. But in terms of just running out of the box and saying, Your Honor, we've asked PTAB to take this case and we're mighty certain they will, we're just waiting to hear, that's not, that's kind of a non-starter in my courtroom for a stay.
So what are some guideposts or factors that defendants can use when there are multiple asserted claims and some are instituted, some aren't? Is it just a complete case-by-case basis, or do you have some kind of factors that you use in deciding that?
Well, I'm really looking for your pitch on whether it's more efficient to have PTAB go forward, or more efficient to have me go forward, to have both of us go forward at the same time. So it is going to be a case-by-case factor. I have generally granted stays, although I denied one recently where there were several, there were I think 15 or 20 claims, and only one of them had been taken up by for IPR, and that claim was not necessarily a make or break claim for the rest of the patent. In that situation, I did not think it made a lot of sense to put everything on hold, and I was a little surprised that the PTAB took just that one claim. But that's the kind of thing where your advice as counsel, because you know the case, you know the patents, you have a vision of how the case is going to unfold, is useful to me.
Okay, and Judge Schrader, I know you see a lot of motions to stay pending IPRs as well. In consolidated cases with multiple defendants, a lot of judges have adopted this estoppel light approach where parties agree to be bound by certain prior art that's been asserted in the IPR, but, and then that way the case will be stayed. Is that, what are your thoughts as to whether that's an effective strategy or not in getting the case stayed?
Let me, I guess, first say that I've not had an opportunity yet to rule on a on an estoppel light concept. The scope of the estoppel obviously, you know, goes to the simplification of the issues factor, in the courts are required to consider in motions to stay. A defendant who is not involved in the IPR but wants the benefit of a stay, it seems to me is going to best simplify the issues by agreeing to the full scope of the statutory provision. The estoppel light concept may simplify issues more than no estoppel at all, but if estoppel light only removes certain art but leaves intact, you know, full-blown invalidity defenses like anticipation and obviousness, that's not really going to simplify the case to the extent that it would justify issuing a stay. So what's happened really in the cases that I have had where the issue has come up either during the briefing or at oral arguments is the parties have agreed to, you know, a full statutory stay.
I'm going to move on to another kind of early motion, early issue in patent cases. We heard earlier today about having certain judges and certain practitioners asking for an early damages trial. And Judge Clark, you and I have talked about this before. Have you guys presided over any patent cases with an early damages trial? And if so or if not, what are your thoughts on having that?
The damages is somewhat interesting because back in 2004, 2005, if you look at the academic and the literature and what the lawyers wanted, because that's about the time I got heavily involved, they wanted to delay damages. What we were hearing, at least in the Eastern District, and all of us would talk about it, they wanted to delay damages until after the Markman. Now, more recently, I've been hearing from the other side, no, now we want to get into damages early. I have always, from my very first management conference, required defendant to, I just say, you know, assume it's going to be fine infringement, you're going to lose on invalidity. What is the base of your sales that the experts are going to work their magic? I don't ask for, I mean, royalty or not, but I want to know what the base is. Gives me an idea, is this a potential multi-million dollar case? Or as in a couple of cases, it was a potential $100,000 case where the clients then went out and settled instantly because the attorney, I also ask at that same hearing, what's your attorney's fees going to be in this case? And those are always several million dollars worth. And I try to get that out early. And I've had a couple of cases settle early on. More recently, I haven't had those kind of show up, maybe because the attorneys have figured out in advance. So I've always tried to do that. Judge Love has actually had, I think, a couple of hearings on damages or mini trials on damages. We've offered that. And with the push now to get early damage discovery in, I think most of us in the Eastern District are open to that. And if the parties agree on it, almost especially, I'd be, you know, or if one side can show, look, this is, even if they win everything, they're only going to win, you know, $50,000, $100,000, or in patent cases, $500,000. We need to nail this down early. I'd sure look at it. When you're talking Samsung versus Apple or something, probably not so much, because the whole reason they're fighting is hundreds of millions of dollars. But I've always thought it was important for early on mediation to at least get a framework and then let the lawyers give an idea. Do they really want to go early discovery, late discovery?
Well, I'm going to ask for each of you guys if you can also describe sort of how your case management conference, initial case management conference goes, because Judge Clark has this pretty extensive case management conference, and I know from practicing before you recently, Judge Donato, you had the practitioners ask about, or you had them talk about the invention and the accused products. Can you guys give a short summary of how your CMCs generally go?
Sure. So I don't think most judges do, but if you have a concept of kind of a boilerplate case management conference, I usually don't do that. If you have the kind of case, and by definition, patent cases will not be this way, where all I need to do is issue a schedule, I probably won't even have you come in if it's that simple. There's no need to spend your money on that. But in a case, particularly a patent case, my first time with seeing you, I like to have, it's non-binding, no one's going to be held to what they say. If you lie to me egregiously, I'm going to remember it, but it's just a conversation for me. So, as Betty said, I like to use it as an opportunity to meet you all, hear you say something, and I'd like to hear you talk about your case. What is the invention? What is the market context for this invention? How are these parties related? Are you competitors? Are you a non-practicing entity that acquired another patent? Are you someone new to the field? Are you the embedded incumbent with a huge market share? I just like to hear, you know, where we're going and what we're doing, in part because, as Judge Freeman said, we still get basically no information in the complaints. I don't know. I mean, in most other cases, I have a full story in the complaint. I get basically nothing in the patent cases because of the way pleadings are done. So I do like to do that. I do like to ask you at that point, how do you want to go forward? I am a big believer that Alice motions, for example, need to be done early. So I will always ask people at the case management conference, are you anticipating a 101 motion? Are you anticipating other motions? Are you going to do summary judgment? How can we set up settlement structures that are going to help you talk about this? I haven't been asked about damages early. That's not come up, but as Judge Clark said, I'm totally open to it. If you want to propose that, I'd be happy to discuss it. So I really do see them as kind of a serious opportunity for you to help me meet you, understand your client, and understand how you want to litigate the case.
Well, you know, I don't handle mine quite that way, although I'm picking up some pointers here, which is always nice. I set my claims construction fairly early in the case, and I use that as my opportunity to learn about the technology in a tutorial and in the Markman hearing itself. So at my case management conference, what I'm really looking for is to find out if there's going to be a 101 motion and to talk to the parties about when I like it to be set. And I actually had, because before I knew these things could happen, I actually had a post-verdict 101 motion filed in a case last year, and I just about came out of my chair because it seemed as though if the party actually believed that was a good motion, why did we have that whole trial? So I learned a lesson, and I learned by my mistakes, but I certainly am a proponent of it being early. And then the question really is, are disputed claims important to being resolved before we do the 101? Because if it's pre-claims construction and pre-summary judgment, I might have to construe the claims in the light of the non-moving party, and that can throw everything off as well. Often it's not based on disputed claims, so we can set that early. Also in the case management conference, I'm really wanting to know, are we going to have a preliminary injunction? I might not know yet. It might not have been filed yet. Often that is what I'm greeted with first, is the preliminary injunction motion. But I'm really sizing up how antagonistic the parties are, how hard fought this litigation is going to be. And unfortunately, I haven't had much success with talking settlement. I've had a string of trials to verdict this year. So I'm looking for those parties who actually want a quick settlement. They're not coming my way. But I don't actually set regular case management conferences after the first one, because I tend to see the parties fairly frequently. So I like to set a schedule, a pretty solid schedule all the way to trial at that first case management conference. One of the reasons I do that is that any day you come in to set a trial with me, you're going to be set out 2.5 to 3 years to get my next available date. So I don't like to wait, and that's just the way my calendar is right now. And we're all busy. So I like to give you the earliest date I can give you. So that's kind of a shock. But then, frankly, 2.5 years goes quickly in these big cases. And I think sometimes lawyers are scurrying to get everything done even in that time. But I do schedule that Markman pretty early. I mean, I can easily do that within 6 or 8 months of filing the complaint. The parties usually aren't ready yet. And then the preliminary injunctions, I actually can't schedule those. I actually schedule summary judgment motions so that I can keep a track on those as well. So I really, for me, it is mostly scheduling, but it's giving me the lay of the land as well.
I handle it largely the way Judge Donato and Judge Freeman do. I see it as an opportunity to meet the attorneys, learn a little bit about the case. We discuss the schedule. We will have given them a trial setting, a Markman hearing date in advance. Obviously, they do their conference prior to that, and have worked out to the extent they can any disagreements over the standard discovery order and the protective order. If they've not resolved those, we try to get those resolved at the case management conference. But I really view it just as an opportunity to learn a little bit about the invention. Learn how strenuously fought the case is going to be, how well the attorneys are going to get along, what to anticipate. We do discuss, the need for and timing issues related to 101 motions, whether claim construction will be necessary prior to that, those type of issues. But I do it in every case. It is time consuming, but I have found that in the long run, it's really worth it.
I do pretty much, or ask pretty much the same questions, but one additional one we'll hear is, I want to know what you know about potential conflicts of interest. We just had a little part of the program on that. And so I'll ask, is anybody here involved in prosecution of the patent? Anybody switch firms and used to be, because that can happen. So if your former partner's on the other side, I want to know about it now, not a month before trial. I truly believe that motions to disqualify a lawyer a month or two before trial are probably just sneaky tactics. If you've got that or you think that's out there, find it out early. And so I'll ask some questions about that to find out if there's any potential conflicts that I've got to deal with early. It's not fair to the client, I don't think. I mean, occasionally it could happen. Somebody hid something, but very unfair to wipe out your trial team shortly before trial. So that's something that I will also push you on. And I think most judges, experienced patent judges, are willing. If you think a mini Markman on that one Markman claim term might be dispositive of everything, maybe bring it up. Talk about it. If you think discovery of X, Y, or Z is a key, or there's going to be a Hague Convention problem with a deposition, I flunked mind reading in law school. If you don't mention it, you know, don't complain to me later on because I didn't give you enough time to add into that. I mean, I'll try to remember to ask that question, but I rely on, this is a very experienced bar. You're the best in the world just about from what I can tell. So let me have your best thoughts on what's the best way to handle the case before you get mad at each other. Later on in the proceedings, you know, it's time to get mad, but right at the beginning, let's figure out how to make the thing work.
Do any of you guys require corporate representatives of the clients to be available or present at the CMCs?
I don't.
Not as a matter of course.
You know, I don't require it, but I've been impressed by how often a client representative comes to the case management or to the major motions. And I really think that I'm in San Jose, so I am really very close to many of the primary offices for these companies. But and I do think word probably gets out because when they're introduced, I acknowledge and thank them for coming. And I think that as lawyers see that I warm to it, they bring more. But I actually mean it sincerely. It actually means a lot to me that this is, that the client is invested and aware of the activities going on in court, and that it's not just completely separate from what the company is doing. So it actually means a lot. I'm actually even surprised that I'm not talking about just the junior person in the GC's office. I am getting really significant corporate leaders who are coming to the hearings, and it makes a difference. I usually get them on both sides, so nobody's getting an advantage, but I can only say keep it up, because I think it makes a difference in your client's ability to assess where the case is going. If they're sitting in court and hearing and seeing it themselves, and they're seeing me and judging me, and I'm the decision maker, seeing how their lawyers are doing against stacking up against the others, I think it's invaluable. Maybe some things lawyers don't always want their clients to see. I don't know, that's your choice, but for me, I really welcome it.
I require it. And they can appear by phone or they can appear live, but I want either lead general counsel and preferably whoever at the corporate level can make a decision, because this is complex, and you need to understand that litigation, that the trial of one of these cases and the disclosures, and I emphasize to them, it's the one chance I get to tell them on your behalf, when you, the lawyer, go ask for information from their engineers and technicians who don't like you and want to make profit and don't want to answer your silly questions, it's not going to help when they suddenly come up with this great information a month before trial. I'm not going to allow it in. But they're not, I know, because I was a lawyer for 20 years, your client doesn't always listen to you when you try to tell them, I've got to have this information now to give to the court in disclosure. And they're going, yeah, you're the lawyer, deal with it. And I've had a number of lawyers tell me that they appreciate it, because then their client understood that these disclosure deadlines and all these other deadlines mean something. They've heard it from the judge. If they ignore it then, I mean, I really don't feel a whole lot of sympathy for them when that key evidence, that key witness is not allowed to testify for being late disclosed. I told them about it. Mm-hmm. And also try to make sure they do understand the process. It's not easy. Yeah, major general corporate counsel understand some of this, but they need, each of us judges are different, so I think it's worthwhile. And like the judge said, I'd like to hear a little bit from them, get a feel for them too. If they're resenting being there, then I know this is going to be a tough case all through there.
I am starting to appreciate Judge Clark's approach. I haven't pulled the trigger on it yet, but I'm thinking about it more. But even that aside, the flip side of what Judge Freeman's experience has been for me is, and I'm going to talk here to all the in-house people, I am amazed that you all don't show up with more regularity, particularly when you're looking at a summary judgment motion or a Markman or some other significant proceeding where you have spent, in all likelihood, six figures in legal fees and costs to get that thing ready for me to decide. I don't see how you can be good consumers of outside counsel work or good protectors of your clients' money if you're not watching your team in court and how I'm responding to them and whether they're effective or ineffective, whether they're making the point, whether they're straying off the point, whether they're prepared and persuasive or whether they're not. So I am consistently surprised given the expense of litigation. And I was just in private practice 3 years ago. I know how much it costs. That you all aren't showing up. Now, you don't have to make an appearance. You can sit in the gallery. I don't have to know you're there if you don't want me to know you're there. But you should have somebody, eyes and ears in the courtroom, because I guarantee you, if you don't do that and the lawyers come back, no matter what happened that day, they're gonna say, we made some progress and we're gonna see what the judge does. Now, the 2 hours leading up to that statement may have been the two most horrific hours a lawyer has ever had in front of a judge, because that lawyer was unprepared, not particularly honest, and did everything he or she could do to make this a hard day for the judge, and the judge let that lawyer know that. You're not going to see any of that. So I really do think for people who are paying the bills, go see your work product. You would not ever go and buy a meal at a high-end restaurant and then not consume it and then just wait for someone else to tell you the food was delicious. Don't do that in your public life, your career, your public life either. Go and watch these things. At a minimum, you're going to see how good your team is. Now, everybody can have a bad day. So you're not saying make a snap judgment after one rough day in court, but if you go three or four times after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, and each of those times you come out feeling a little sick to your stomach, you should think about whether you've got the right team. I really am surprised that more corporate folks don't show up for these things.
I'll just mention, I didn't try patent cases as a trial lawyer, but I had a lot of big corporate counsels and insurance companies that were defending the people I were, and they would have an experienced adjuster, an experienced person from the company watching. And it was a little bit nerve-wracking, especially when I was first starting, to know he was back there. And the judge suddenly looks at me and says, "You mean what?" And you're going, "Oh." Because it's not just the judge, it's your client. But at least they could then, when I went and said, "I think we can settle for this or do whatever that." And Markman's a perfect example. I've had several Markman hearings where it was pretty obvious the expert witness they had was just about worthless and incredible, and no one was going to believe him or her. No matter what. Maybe at one time they were good, but over the years they've lost it. That'd be a good chance for the corporate person to look at that person. Maybe a different engineer would be good. It's one chance where you're getting a free shot at that. So I think Judge Donato's right on point on that one.
Well, we're going to move on to claim construction. Does anyone have any questions about what we've discussed so far in terms of early motions? Case procedure.
For Alice motions, it seems that almost every case that I'm involved in now has an early Alice motion by at least one of the defendants, and that the patent owners are now, or the plaintiffs are always claiming that claim construction is necessary, and therefore they try to kick it down the road until after claim construction. How do you go about addressing those types of arguments on these cases that where you see these?
The one thing I do is if the plaintiff is going to take that position, I want them to be able to demonstrate precisely why claim construction is necessary. What needs to be construed and why? And, you can do that informally at a case management conference when the case is in its earliest stages, or you can do it later by telephone or, in person. I'm like Judge Donato and most judges. I think 101 motions should be dealt with early in the case. That's the point, really. I want to know from the party who takes the view that claim construction is necessary exactly why it is.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've done is that I allow the motion early. I'm not going to change my Markman hearing just because someone wants a 101 early, But the moving party is going to have to concede the construction that the non-moving party
right.
wants.
Right.
And I've actually had moving parties say that's not a problem, because they've already exchanged their constructions, because they're working up to the Markman hearing. And they will go forward because they think they can win really on the bigger issue of the subject matter. So, you know, I think that I have never been forced to change my schedule in order to have the Markman in advance. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, that the defendant really has a lot of sway there.
I've got a question about damages. And this builds off of an earlier panel, which y'all may have been here for or not. The question is, you know, when I'm a plaintiff, I have the perception that in my expert report on damages, I can really just shoot for the moon and swing for the fences, because if I lose a Daubert motion, I'm going to get a second bite at the apple, because I feel... it's not my personal perception, but I think there's a perception out there that judges are unwilling to you know, leave a plaintiff on the eve of trial with no damages case. So they often get another bite at the apple. What's your reaction to that perception, and have you seen anything like that play out in your cases or in your courtrooms, and would you find a way to maybe change that?
So I'm not a second bite at the apple person. And I generally am hearing my Daubert motions close enough to trial that it's, you know, to me, it's not your first offer. And I am not going to hear round after round of Daubert motion on these ridiculous theories that I mean, you can't even put them forward with a straight face. They're so absurd. So, there are no clear standards for the damages theories. With the judges, we are left with this sitting in our laps on all kinds of theories. I mean, you can name them there as long as your arm that keep coming up that are often preposterous. But I think that if lawyers start to realize this is your one and only chance, it's kind of baseball arbitration, be careful what you ask for, because you may just be out on the street there. But maybe others are giving a second chance. I don't know.
I try to handle that in my scheduling order by setting a deadline for disclosure of experts. But my deadline for Daubert motions or motions to exclude is based upon the date someone discloses. So if you wait to disclose your experts until so close to trial that the other side is going to be able to pin you just before trial, that's kind of your choice. You could have disclosed a lot earlier. If you want to play games because you think it's going to put them in a bind by disclosing late, obviously, that's a tactic you can try, but be very careful about that, because the way my schedule is set up, you could have disclosed earlier and then had some time in there. In fact, if you do it more than 7 weeks prior, then, or 6 weeks, depending on what I put in that particular schedule, sometimes it's even five, there's even time to get a new expert if you had to, because I've seen that. I've seen some unfairness in that procedure. So. Part of that is if the plaintiff waits so late to disclose that the other side files their motion just on the eve of trial, I try to do the schedule in order to avoid that. I perceive that as unfair, but I try to avoid that in the schedule. But the expert report with everything in it, you're running a risk there. I agree with the judge that why not come out with a good expert report?
Yeah, there is an easy alternative. Come out with
right.
Be credible in your damages model. I hear people say that. I don't know a single judge who routinely lets you run the table, and if it doesn't work out, you get a second chance. I mean, no one in our district that I know of, and I know them all, does that. I would not do that. You take your chance, and if you've elected to have an irresponsible or reckless model and you lose, that's your time is over. You can still present damages.
Yeah.
Now, there's this myth that you have to have an expert. You don't. You do not need an expert to present damages. And I got in many occasions, in my experience, it's better to have a non-expert. If you have somebody from your company, you can come in and say, here's what we should have done, and here's what we did do, and here's the delta, and here's why we think we're entitled to that. That's actually often, in my view, much more credible to a jury, and in some cases to me, than you know, the person who does nothing but 24/7 damages opinions for whoever has hired her. So don't, you know, if you're going to be outlandish, you have to expect to pay a consequence if the judge says that's not acceptable. And the consequence is you don't get to have a round two in my court.
I agree with that. I mean, I will say I think sometimes there, one of the things that I have not adjusted to really is having, I think I have been frustrated a time or two by getting close to trial and not having had an opportunity to deal with all of the threshold motions. And so there have been occasions where really for no one's fault other than my fault and my chamber's fault is that we haven't dealt with Daubert motions until the last moment. And so, and that's just a frustrating part of the job, and it just it does happen. So I, you know, although those are required to be filed earlier, sometimes we just don't get to them until the eve of trial. And I have occasionally allowed amended reports when I felt like it was my fault. But for the most part, it's you know, it's not a whole new theory.
Okay, well, Judge Clark, you and I have discussed this before, but judges used to not issue claim construction orders. So, for example, Judge White here in Northern District, California, would construe claims during trial, and Judge Alsup now in Northern District, California, doesn't construe claims unless they're part of a summary judgment motion. What are your thoughts as to whether that practice should be more heavily adopted?
And actually, before, I guess, the Markman opinion, that was kind of the standard. One of my partners used to be involved in this. I used to laugh at him because I thought it was a silly area of the law. I didn't know how much they were going to start paying lawyers in this field. Back then, they were just getting the same as everybody else. But that was the standard. But on the other hand, by the time we got into Markman, what I was hearing was, it makes sense. It's very hard for the experts and for the lawyers to come up with a theory if the terms haven't been construed. Now, I understand the concept of file it with a motion for summary judgment, and that's a little bit like the mini Markman. If you've got one or two issues and it's going to make, I mean, it's golden. It makes the summary judgment fine. Put it in there. But I have always tried to do the early Markman, but a lot of that was based on what we were hearing from the lawyers that it's pretty essential to the case. And it's hard for me to see, and I've had to actually, under 02, twice construe claims during trial. And that was not easy. I mean, I did not like that, because partly the jury's sitting around wondering why on earth lawyers and judges, all their education, can't keep a trial moving along. I don't think that's good. So I tend to go early on it. But I can see the summary judgment method, the doing it during trial, that's got to be very difficult, especially in some kind of a complex software type case. Maybe not in a motorcycle part case. It might depend on the case itself.
So I've had this come up in a lot of ways that have been really very difficult for me. I decided early on, and in practice of doing this, really am firm in it. I like an early Markman because it's when I can learn about the invention and understand the claims in the case. And I actually don't want to be swayed by the summary judgment positions of the parties as to what my construction ought to be. Because at that point, it's really easy to say, well, if I construe it this way, this one will win, and if I construe it that way. So, and you know, I'm just really trying to keep myself very neutral in the construction. So I am in a bubble when I'm doing it, and I don't understand why certain terms need to be construed or what hinges on it. But I don't actually think that I need to know that. So I like it separate. It also is it's a tremendous amount of work for a judge to do claims construction and summary judgment in one motion. It really is. To me, it would be a little bit overwhelming. But the caveat that I've come to learn through this horrible problem of having to construe claims during trial is that, to me, the real issue is a narrowing of the infringement contentions along the way to get down to a reasonable number of claims that will be tried. Because what I'm finding is that the downside of my early Markman is that there might be 6 or 7 patents and 150 claims that have been asserted. And so we require in our local rules that it be only 10 claims. So they pick 10 claims. But under O2 Micro, I mean, actually, you know, I mean, you're right. We have the obligation of construing the claims that are in contention before the jury. And so I have come to the belief that I need to put strict controls on reducing the number of claims in contention early in the case. It's controversial. I know that it is. But the idea being that, again, I'm not going to, the first 10 are not just your first offer, because I've had the situation where we get to trial and the claims I construed, the plaintiff says, well, forget that one and forget that one. How about these others that are virgin and the judge has never seen? And then we get to trial and it's a matter of, well, judge, you know, I know we're going to trial tomorrow, but here are 3 terms you have to construe because their expert wants to give a construction and O2 Micro says only you can do that. Obviously true. And so there's this tension in my view between whether I can, and I think I get support from the Federal Circuit, we'll see, whether I can say, well, we have a procedure for you asking for additional claims construction and you didn't follow it, and you didn't make the request, so you don't get to just show up on the first day of trial and announce that more terms need to be construed. Now, I didn't follow that when it came up. I actually did what I had to do and construed the claims, and it's not pretty at the last minute. I mean, it's a chart, and it's here's the term, and here's the construction, and there's no explanation of it, because that's all you can get. Now, as lawyers tell me, they don't care. I mean, when they go to the Federal Circuit, no one's going to read my order, so it probably doesn't matter. I mean, it's a trial judge's view. You can tell me whether the trial judge's order on claims construction ever meant anything. But that's the complexity that I see about the case and your strategy and how frustrating it can be.
I agree with both my colleagues. One thing I've started to do recently, and I'm thinking about putting it as a standard practice, is I now, when people say, oh, we have 15 claims or 20 claims or 30 claims, I now say, well, you need to prioritize. So I'm going to, you pick your 10, because that's what our local rules do, but those are your top 10, and then you rank those. This is our number one most important claim that we want you to construe. Here's our second most important, here's our third. So I'll let you do that, but that helps me later when you come back and say, oh, well, actually, these 3 claims are super critical. I said, you know, you told me earlier that your top 10 claims were these 10 claims. You put them in their top priority. You didn't mention anything about these claims, so I'm not going to do it. This is not going to happen. We don't have the time or the resources for that, and I think you're playing a game. So part of what I'm trying to do to manage that is you tell me. You pick them, but you tell me your top 10. In the order that you believe they matter to your case.
I believe each of you have slightly different procedures for tutorial and Markman. Can you each describe what you prefer in terms of the tutorial Markman process?
Go ahead.
I don't really have a formal procedure. I think parties frequently do it, and I always find it helpful. But I have a lot of Markmans where there's no tutorials.
So I always have a tutorial, but partly because I have no technical background whatsoever. So it's a challenge for me, and I actually do it in a very uniform way. I have a tutorial set on a separate day, and it's unreported actually. And I give each side generally an hour for each side. I rarely have witnesses coming. It's usually lawyer argument only. They walk me through the invention, tell me about it. They come back 1 week later for the Markman hearing. And so what that allows for me is that I can read the briefs for the Markman quickly before the tutorial. I can ask some questions about the nature of the claims in the invention at the tutorial to understand it. And then as it kind of washes over me a few times, by the time they come for the Markman, I really feel like I'm ready to hear the more sophisticated arguments on the actual constructions.
I do something similar. I do a week before the Markman, I have a tutorial. Like Judge Freeman, mine is off the record because I wanted to just have a good conversation that nobody gets bound by. It can't be used against anybody. But unlike Judge Freeman, I usually bar the lawyers from doing it. I want to hear from an engineer. I want to hear from a client. or an expert. I don't want to hear the lawyers. The lawyers, in my experience, cannot resist turning it into a preemptive strike, and I just don't need that. What I want to hear about is somebody who's in the trenches with that technology, who lives with it, works with it, produces it, designed it, whatever, can actually have a conversation with me about what this thing is supposed to do. So I want to hear directly from a non-lawyer in that circumstance. And I happen to enjoy tutorials. I find them interesting. I have not had one yet that I thought was a waste of time. And like Judge Freeman, once I get to the Markman, I can hit the ground running, and it makes things a lot more efficient.
Well, I'll only my counterpoint to that, and I think that's great if you can keep up with the experts. But I had the experience a couple years ago where, to me, a very difficult case involving very complicated technology, the expert came in to do the tutorial. He said, "Judge, I'm going to give you an hour-long course in college-level physics." And the little bubble over my head was saying, "Does he know I didn't take high school physics?" So that's why I rather have you all come in and talk to me, because you might not have taken physics in high school either, and you've learned how to tell me about it.
In that case, the little bubble over my head would have been, "This is a bad expert." You should hire someone who can talk to people.
Yeah.
I will ask for what I call a synopsis, and basically it's in writing, or it could be a PowerPoint slide, however you want to do it. From a look at, I will put on the calendar a tutorial date just in case your synopsis, both sides, are so terrible I can't understand any of it. But I'd prefer to read it. And some counsel, some sides do a real good job. I mean, do you really want the judge to not know the difference between a bit and a byte? I mean, that's a simple. But if you're not, some lawyers will basically give me the patent and then give me the argument that's in their brief, and they've just blown their chance. And other sides, they'll actually start off with, "Well, here's the basic definitions of the technological terms, and here's maybe a little background of how the radio was discovered or invented or whatever, and then now we're moving." I mean, some real technology, and that helps. Those particular synopses help a great deal. And on the especially the computer software kinds of things, machine code, I will have a technical advisor, either from Rice University or Texas A&M, somebody I insist who teaches entry-level classes in addition to doing research and so forth, because I want someone who can talk to freshmen and sophomores, and then I may go over the synopsis for that person. And someone, I don't ever have them write anything for me in turn, but I try to make sure I understand the actual technology if I can't get it from the synopses or the books, or maybe they can get me the text or whatever. So I use that. I've never really had to ask for the experts from y'all to come in live. Once or twice, someone has sent to me a video of the expert giving me the synopsis, and in that case, it worked pretty well too. But it saved a lot of travel time. He didn't have to come to Beaumont or Lufkin or wherever to do it. But if you get that opportunity, don't waste it with lawyer talk. Help us understand your technology so we'll understand your arguments when we get to them.
In the Northern District of California, generally when you file a motion, you can pencil in a hearing date for the motion automatically based on when the next motion's hearing date is. But that's not really general practice in EDTX. So I was wondering, Judge Schrader, for you, what kind of motions do you generally seek a hearing on?
We have hearings in a lot of motions. We have hearings in almost every motion to transfer, motions to stay, 101 motions. And there's no formal process for scheduling the hearing. We usually talk about it at the initial scheduling conference or case management conference. But my experience is, that when a motion is filed, if the party asks for it, we'll do everything we can to schedule it. And it might be this month, it might be next month, but we'll do everything we can to have hearings. I think they're very, very helpful. It helps to acquaint me with the legal issues that are involved, and it gives me an opportunity to ask the parties questions. So I'm a big believer in hearings.
I'm going to move on to a slightly different topic, which is discovery disputes. Judge Donato, I know you have a letter briefing procedure for discovery disputes. Can you tell us the origin of having that procedure and why?
Well, it originated in being ground into the ground repeatedly as a junior lawyer when I had to spend a lifetime of nights and weekends writing either motions to compel or oppositions to motions to compel. More generally, most of the judges in our district do that now, okay? I happen to do a 3-page letter per side. A couple other judges do 3, some do 5. A few still refer their cases to magistrate judges, Judge Freeman, for example. It's basically a reflection of caseload and other factors. There's no right answer. I like to do it. I know Judge Alsup and a bunch of other judges in San Francisco to keep it as well. The main point is that is such a loss center for attorney time and money that anything I feel a judge can do to make it more efficient and much less expensive is good. I mean, you can get cases, in the old days, you'd spend tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on discovery motions. I mean, it was, and then you would always get a compromise result. I mean, it was the equivalent, as a judge told me once, it was the equivalent of, buying a new BMW, driving it for a mile, and then pushing it over the side of a cliff. That's the value you got back from that money. So. I also do the hearings on the telephone. It's the only time I do telephonic hearings, so I can get a letter 1 week, get a response the week after. I'll have you on the phone week after that. It's done in 3 weeks. It's done in 6 to 8 pages. It's done off the record. I don't report it, so we can have a candid conversation, and it has worked extraordinarily well in my patent cases, my antitrust cases, every other case I have. So. I think it's proven its value, in my eyes at least, over the last several years that I've been on the bench.
And Judge Schrader, I know you've recently eliminated the requirement for having an in-person meet and confer before a discovery motion is filed. Can you tell us the impetus behind that change?
Yes. As many people in this room are aware, in-person meet and confers by lead counsel and local counsel in discovery disputes has been utilized by judges in the Eastern District for a long time, intermittently, I might add. I think that requirement sometimes works in a case, but it also has unintended consequences in others. There was a suggestion that was made by a number of lawyers, both national counsel and local counsel, that we might look at eliminating that requirement and replacing it with something that might be more effective. Judge Gilstrap and I, this is not a change to the local rule, by the way, but Judge Gilstrap and I asked a number of very active practitioners in our court to meet over several weeks and make some recommendations, and what they came up with and recommended that we adopt, which we did in standing orders, was to eliminate the meet and confer in-person requirement. It still requires the meet and confer process before the filing of a motion. And then once the motion is filed, within, I think, 72 hours of a hearing having been set, the parties, national counsel and local counsel, and no others, are required to meet and confer again on the telephone, and then certify to the court that they've done that and they've done their dead level best to work out the disagreement. If the agreement has been resolved, that's great. If it hasn't, the court can order further briefing, it can do a number of things, or it can just go forward with the hearing. So that has been the change to our practice via the standing order. And again, I think it was adopted, we adopted it in the summer, so we've only had a few months' experience with it, but it seems to be working.
I think we can probably take one or two questions if you guys have any.
I can add one thing to the discovery if you want.
Sure.
I'll tell you, the judge who impressed me most when I was very young was a guy named Lucius Bunton. And the Lucius Bunton rule was, if you bring a discovery dispute, someone's paying a sanction. I may not apply that the first time you come to me with a dispute, but I see this is what's going on. I think about old Judge Bunton wandering around West Texas, and someone's going to pay. And actually, the rules provide for that. I mean, people forget that. There is a shall provision in there, and we have the authority. One of you is going to be wrong. Think about that before you just snipe, snipe, snipe. And from general counsel's point of view, maybe that's your model, but a lot of money, as the judge said, is spent on this kind of stuff. That you all know the rules of discovery is about the same as we do. I mean, in most courtrooms, there's 200 or 300 years of experience facing myself with like 30. You're going to know the rules. Be very careful about that kind of thing, because it can work against you very badly.
Sure.
So I'd like to ask a question to the judges about...
ask a question to the judges about next-generation lawyers and how you would like or what opportunities they would have to get their real on-the-feet training in your courtrooms.
Let me take that. That comes up on the motions thing. One thing that I've started to do, and Judge Barbara Lynn in the Northern District has actually got it, one of her rules, if you want a hearing, which I don't normally grant, most of mine are done on the paper, and you'll tell me you'll bring a lawyer with 5 years or less experience to argue it, I may give you that hearing, but then don't let you think that the senior partner is going to get up to introduce the young lawyer. The young lawyer is going to have to get up and stand on his or her feet and argue it. And oddly enough, it works, because they put a lot more time into it than the old lawyer did. The last one of those I had was a motion to reconsider. My first thought, reconsider? This young girl's going to tell me I'm wrong? What a joke. Well, by the time she had finished, yep, I was wrong. And the old partners, I'm looking at them saying, why didn't you bring this up the first time we had this hearing? Why did I have to wait for her to do it?
That's great.
So it was great. But that's one way of doing it is, it takes some extra time. And not all judges like to do it because it puts some pressure, but it's something to think about. I might not actually insist on every case, but it's important.
Mm-hmm. I'll echo what Judge Clark said. I do informal instruction conferences, you know, the night before the jury's to be instructed and the jury gets the case. And we do it around a long table, and it's very, it's on the record, but it's very relaxed. And I use it as an opportunity for the lawyers to convince me that the proposed instructions I've given them are just really wrong, and I'm going to get reversed. But it's very casual, and a lot of times we work through issues that haven't been resolved, and we get them resolved. And then in the morning, I'll give them an opportunity to put their objections formally on the record. But what I see in almost every one of those is the young lawyer in the room is making the argument about the jury charge, and they do a fantastic job. Just as Judge Clark said, they've worked so hard, and they know the case inside out, and they know the law. And very often, I've changed my mind about what the correct instruction is on the basis of someone who's been out of law school 2 or 3 years. I will say this, I know there are a lot of proposals out there. I think there's a lot of attractiveness to, you know, giving more time or giving hearings. I have a lot of cases where I see young lawyers stand up in the courtroom and do an outstanding job. And so I just haven't felt the need to do that yet. But I certainly think it's to be encouraged, and there are a lot of really great young lawyers out there.
You know, it's really interesting. I always am grateful when firms put their younger lawyers forward to give them the opportunity. I haven't put it in my standing orders. I don't say anything to lawyers that I encourage it. And frankly, the reason I don't is that I'm very sensitive to the fact that the client really needs to make the decision on who is going to represent that client in court. And I think it is the firm's responsibility to train their lawyers and send them in for argument. Now, I give argument in virtually all of my cases, so I have nothing to offer. It's not like I'm going to decide on the papers and you can do this. But I'm very torn by it because it's a very important question.
I do have it in my standing order, and a number of my our Northern District colleagues have it as well. Mm-hmm. I love it. I encourage it for all the reasons that you've heard. I have to say, I find that I have to kind of chase people to do it. I am surprised by the lack of enthusiasm. I just had a case recently where I said, I don't need argument, but if you send in some younger lawyers, I'd be happy to do it. And one side said, great, and the other side said, well, we can only send in, you know, a junior partner. That's it. That's the only person who can do this. The entire firm, that's it. One person, and that person's a junior. And, you know, it's just, I'm intrigued. Maybe I'm reading too much on what I heard Judge Clark say. I'm intrigued by the idea of trying to force the issue, but I just haven't pulled the trigger on that yet. Mm-hmm. In every case, I understand what Judge Freeman's saying. I totally agree. But in every case, there is one opportunity where a younger person can argue the motion or argue something. And I think it must be clients who are saying, well, I just don't want to do that. And I think you need to get over that because, like Judge Clark, I would much rather hear from the person who wrote the brief, read all the cases, did a 50-state survey and a 98-district survey of what the case law is, than the older person who read it 2 days before the oral argument and is just parroting what's in the brief. I've read the brief. I don't need a parrot. I need someone who's going to be able to say to me when I read the cases, which I do, why does this case make sense on these facts? And 9 times out of 10, the non-brief writer cannot answer that question, and I get the lame, well, we'd be happy to file a supplemental submission on that, which is just their way of saying, I have no idea. I haven't read that case. I'm just the old person who's been asked to argue. I don't need that. I'd rather see someone who's ready to come in. And for clients out there, if you're worried that you're going to lose because a younger lawyer slips up, at least with me, you're not, all right? Now, is a younger lawyer often going to say a sentence or two more than she should have? Probably. I guarantee you I'm not going to hold that against you. I'm not going to say, now you've just flipped me and I'm going to deny the motion I was just about to grant until you made that one statement. That's not going to happen. So don't worry about that. We're looking to promote the profession as well as see that you get a zealous advocate. So it's not going to be held against you even if a mistake gets made.
And that does tie into something that Judge Donato said earlier about having someone from corporate watching what's going on. Sometimes it's so obvious that the young engineer lawyer who understands that technology, you can see him or her constantly handing up notes to senior partner about
right,
it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Well, you think that the judge is blind?
Right.
I mean, I know who knows this stuff. And, and once or twice, I've always said, wait a minute, counsel, let me ask the guy. I mean, I wouldn't do that
so
in front
true.
Of a jury. But you know, the person who wrote the brief, the person who knows the technology, maybe they're the ones who can explain the question in a way that makes sense. They probably use this technology all the time and have since they were children, whereas the partner who's my age, well, if they're my age, they learn penmanship with a quill pen. So, and that's serious.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the panel.